We are gathered together in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God who has come in flesh. Psalm 106, verses 7 through 18, let us read our text. Our fathers in Egypt weren't insightful into your extraordinaries. They didn't remember your loving kindnesses and caused defiance at a sea, in the sea of water weed. And he saved them for his namesake to make his might known. And he rebuked at the sea of water weed, and it dried. And he caused them to walk in the raging mass of water as in the wilderness. And he saved them from the hand of the one hating, and redeemed them from the hand of the enemy. And waters covered up their adversaries. Not one of them was left. And they believed his words. They sang his praise. They hurried. They forgot his occupations. They didn't intensely wait for his counsel. And they always longed a longing in the wilderness. And they tried God in a desolation. And he gave to them their request and sent forth emaciation into their soul. And they were jealous toward Moses in the camp, toward Aaron, Holy One of Yahweh. The earth opens and swallows Dathan and covers up the congregation of Abiram. And a fire burned in their congregation, a flame intensely flamed wicked ones. You will remember that these psalms, these early hundreds psalms, are grouped according to subject matter. The big subject matter being psalms that recount the history of Israel, mainly in the Exodus, sometimes spilling over into the conquest generation as well. Also, maybe just because that subject matter, what they're talking about, but probably not, we have the comparison between God's extraordinaries and his occupations. His extraordinaries being what we would call miracles. His occupations, what we might call his policies. That is, policy is, this is the way we function all the time. This is the way God functions toward his believers all the time. So occupations, we see them here. We also see extraordinaries here, or extraordinaries, depending on how you want to pronounce that. So that's we've got this common subject matter here. Let's look at this and then glean applications, wisdom, prudence from what our fathers endured and what our brothers and sisters endured in. Today we're solely in the Exodus generation. Our fathers in Egypt weren't insightful into your extraordinaries. That is, they saw miracles. It's very simple, actually. We've got a big piece of scripture in front of us, so I'm going to be terse in my explanation, except for certain points. Very simply, they didn't learn lessons from God's miracles. They saw his displays of power, but they didn't respond commensurately. They did not respond to those extraordinaries appropriately. They, frankly, weren't grateful which would be the right response, and thus weren't insightful into his extraordinaries. They didn't remember your loving kindnesses. Note that it's not loving kindness in the singular, but loving kindnesses in the plural. So we're talking about acts of loving kindness. We're talking about individual displays or demonstrations or manifestations of God's loving kindness. The things that God does to show loving kindness, they are myriad, they are plethora, they are abundant, but they didn't remember them. That is, if I would have remembered how God has shown me kindness, that would argue for my relating to him in a certain way, given that I have been shown such off-the-charts kind of kindness. What does that say about how we ought then live? You know, there are different words. We have different languages here. In the verse that I'm about to refer to, in this one, I would not translate this as compassions. I would not translate the word that I would translate, that I have translated compassions in Greek, as loving kindness. But, you know, compassions and loving kindnesses, they're very closely related in the clemency network. It's that God did not have to be good to me this way, and he did. It's those kinds of things. So like this, in that he shows loving kindness, loving kindnesses, plural, and multiplied loving kindnesses. And then, if I would remember that, I would treat God the way a recipient of loving kindnesses should treat him. I would respond to God in a way that a recipient of multiple loving kindnesses should respond to him. And that's very much like when Paul urges us in Romans chapter 12, by the compassions of God, to give our bodies, offer our bodies as living sacrifices. In Romans, there it's 12:1. Paul has, in a systematic way, been unfolding in a logical progression how and why God has given us such benevolence. That it was through the death and resurrection of his divine Son, the one of the same essence as he, the same being, but this other person, for lack of a better term, and I've got to find a better term for this, but it's served the church well enough for the last, since the 300s, when they started formulating creeds. The word person has served us well enough, for lack of a better term, but person of the Son of his essence, he gave to death, and what a death. And upon the basis of that death and then rising to life again of the Son, he has redeemed us. He has justified us. It was the reason, because he knew he would do that to make it justly possible. It was the reason he could foreknow us. It was the reason that he could predestine us. He called us in time. He has glorified us in Jesus Christ. He has given us of His Holy Spirit. I'm going through Romans in my mind, if you don't know what I'm doing. And then he gives us everlasting security in Himself. And then He says, I encourage you by the compassions of God. And then he launches into, from chapter 12, the hortatory section of the book of Romans. In other words, let's put it in a grammatical way. Indicatives always precede imperatives. That is, indicatives are statements. Imperatives are commands. If you look, you especially see it in Paul's writings, it's almost a classic Pauline outline. He will spend usually a greater part in indicatives than in imperatives. In places like Ephesians, there it's just about equal. But the first part of these epistles are all indicatives, statements about what God has done. God's done this. Man, if I did this with Ephesians, if I went through Ephesians in my mind rather than Romans, He has elected us. He has predestined us. He has given us mercy. He has opened up to us the wisdom of God that He made known to the angels by means of the church. He has given His Son to us. He has raised His Son from the dead, higher than all principality, power, every name that's named. He's given Him as head over all things to the church. He has given us mercy that you can't even fathom yet. He says in 2:7 that in the ages to come, in other words, God has already done it, but we don't know what it is yet, in the discernible eras of, yes, time, in what we tend to call eternity, God's going to make up new eras, new epochs, new slots, new ages in time, just to put on display the mercy that He has given to us in Christ Jesus. He saved us by grace. He did that through faith. It has nothing to do with ourselves. He's created us anew in Christ Jesus. I'm just up to 2:10 now in Ephesians, and I left a lot of chapter 1 out, all right? But it's indicative, like God did this for you, 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 and then you'll hit the imperative section. And He'll tell you, now you do this. He did this. He did this, 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 this. Now you do this. And don't do this. In other words, it's based on a right response to what we've understood about just how blasted good God is to us. He's so good to us. This generation that Psalm 106 is talking about, in a practical way, forgot about the multiplied plural loving kindnesses. And so what they did was something that was very inappropriate, very improper, given how well they had been treated. They caused defiance at a sea. Now, maybe you don't think of it when you read it in the book of Exodus. It's there, but you're looking more at the bad guys that are coming after them and the trouble that they're in and what God's going to do from them. But they make these statements at the sea, at the Red Sea, that are just after you've watched 10 plagues and a miraculous, you know, exit by power, God's power on your behalf, out of Egypt. Now you get to the Red Sea, and they start defying. Now, maybe in our minds we don't take a word like this. It's a strong word, defiance. Maybe we think that's too strong a word. I'm sure you don't think it's too strong a word if you believe that I've translated it correctly. You're not going to say the Bible's wrong. But maybe if you didn't see it there, you'd say, maybe defiance isn't the right word for that. Because you find this all too easy and all too normal. This kind of thing where you put out words of complaint, kind of obliquely directed to God. That's what they did. That's defiance. And they did this at a sea, so we're talking about the Red Sea, but the Red Sea, I don't actually know what's red about it. Why do we call it that? Why do we call it the Red Sea? I don't know why it's called the Red Sea. But what I want you to understand is that's a modern name for this. So when you see in the Bible, when you see our conventional translations, you'll now know that you'll never see that in mine. But in the conventional translations, when it refers to the Red Sea, they're using a modern name for that. It is Yom Suf in Hebrew. Yom is sea and Suf is like seaweed, or what I'm translating here as water weed, because there's another Hebrew word that I'm translating as seaweed. This suf is the stuff that Jonah talks about when he was thrown overboard, and he was in the Mediterranean, which they would call the Great Sea at the time, and it said, he said, the suf had wrapped around my head. That's how deep he went before he was swallowed by the whale. I defy anybody to live that long. I defy anybody to go that deep. Actually, I don't defy people. I hope they never have. I hope it never happens to you. But to get down that deep some way or another, either because the great fish is somehow playing with you, like a plaything or something, I think I could do that. I don't even know how you get down that deep until you get to seaweed. Maybe it's not that deep. But then the fish is so big. But the point is, you may not be able to get down that deep because you're a normal human and you can, even without trying, float. I could get down that deep, let me tell you. And Jonah was, must have been like me. And he's got suf wrapped around his head. It may be what he has inside the fish. That when he's inside, the suf is wrapped around his head because there's suf inside the fish. But this is the kind of weed that grows in the sea. Some of the stuff that I used to in my maniacal past. If your muscles were big enough and you told me this is good for you, then I'm taking it. And some of the dumbest things that I ingested back in those days. But one of them was somebody told me, take kelp. Kelp is seaweed. And I took those tablets, and I couldn't swallow them, so I had to chew them. And these are, oh, it's bad. It's bad. Oh, my. Anyway. Suf. It's suf tablets is what I ate. The sea, the Red Sea, as it's called today, has a lot of that in it. And so it's called the sea that is characterized by water weed. The sea of water weed. You'll often hear even those who try to attempt a more literal rendering of it, but don't call it the Red Sea, but they don't call it the sea of water weed. They'll often call it the sea of reeds. Because reeds are those like cattails and things like that, those kind of water vegetation. They caused defiance at the sea of water weed. And he saved them. He saved them. For his name's sake. If you ever ask the question, why does he put up with these people? There are multiple reasons, actually. One is that his loving nature and his commitment to devotion doesn't change. That's one reason. So he doesn't change. That's a big reason. Another reason, though, is because of his namesake. There are multiple reasons that he continues to deal with us. Another reason is he's a father. Father has a child that is, or parent has a child, your average, your normal parent. I know there are parents that are not like this, but your normal parent, no matter how much headaches, the one that they have begotten or born, given their gender, give them, they will love that kid long past kiddom. They will love that kid, that child, for the rest of their lives. And that's what God's doing. God's saying, I cause you to be born again, and this is the way it is for eternity future now. I love you, and I actually am not, and we're not just talking about devotion. I've got an affection for God. You could say, I have an affection for you for the rest of eternity. It's never going to change. If God, before incarnation, if we're talking about the Father after incarnation, if he had hair, he could pull his hair out over you. But it's not going to change how much he desperately loves us. Just not going to change. I mean, just if you've never had it, I tell you to do this all the time. If you never do this before, if you have never taken me up on it before, take me up on it now, right now, settle it right now. It's like, I will always be loved by God. I will always be divinely loved. I'm a divinely loved one for the rest of my life. Time and eternity. Eternity passed before I knew about it because I couldn't know about anything because it wasn't even created yet. God knew I'm creating this Jamoke and he's going to be a real screw up. And I'm loving him. I'm loving him for eternity. For eons of time and beyond it, this one's mine. That's a big reason. That's a huge reason. But there's another reason, and it deals with his name. So that reason deals with, it's really, both of them really deal with him. He's like this no matter what we are like. But then he's like this, and he does care about how he is perceived outside even of his people. Do you recall that there were a couple times, and God does not change his mind. He was at the time, he was not a man that he could change his mind. Once he became a man, he still didn't change his mind. But the idea is that there were times when God put it like this to Moses, and you know this can't happen, and God knows the end from the beginning, and God knew that he would not allow this to happen, but he teaches us this way. And he says to Moses, and if Moses took him up on it, he would do so, but he knows that Moses won't take him up on it, and he can't be wrong. So he says, remove yourself from these people, that I may consume them in a moment. And I will make of you a whole new nation. I understand that God knows that's not going to happen, and you understand that God can't even do that and keep his word on other situations, right? For instance, a lawgiver will not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. Well, Moses isn't from Judah, and for that lawgiver promise to be carried out, he can't start a whole new nation just with Moses. But the idea is, Moses then prevails upon God, not in the sense that he's changed him, but Moses entreats God, and he says to him, don't do this because of your name. The Egyptians will hear of it, and they will say, Yahweh, who they will think of as one among many gods, one of a pantheon, Yahweh was strong enough to redeem them from Israel, but he was not, from Egypt rather, but he was not strong enough to sustain them in the wilderness. And God acquiesces to that, thinks that's a good idea. Not like he's learning anything. I've already told you. He already knows this. everything that's going down before it happens. But it illustrates for us, he does that so that, knowing what Moses will say, he can then do this thing written for our instruction so that we see that God is indeed concerned about his name. And here he tells us that that's why he saved them. He saved them for his namesake. And then there is a further reason, to make his might known. In other words, so that they don't say, he must not have this much might. He's got this much might. He's got a lot of might, but he doesn't have this much might to be able to sustain 2 million people in the wilderness. To make his might known, for the sake of his name, he saves them. Verse 9, and he rebuked at the sea of water weed, and it dried. And he caused them to walk in the raging mass of water as in the wilderness. You know, the parting was, it's all part of one miracle. But there's more to the miracle than you may just think of. In the, how much water went to either side of that path that he cut in the sea. I won't tell you all the water that wasn't in that path. I'm talking even about the water that was saturating that the floor of that sea. I'm thinking of something that last time I talked about this, I thought about it. I had recently been gone into just walking walking in a stream with my grandchildren, and it was mud. And I mean, as soon as I put my weight on that thing, I sunk like about up to my knees. That's scary when you go from sole to knee that fast, because you don't think this is going to stop. I mean, it went really fast. And you're trying to get out of it. That wasn't the situation. They went past on dry ground, and though it wasn't going to be successful for the chariots went in, and you know then what he did? Then he jammed their wheels. He made it so that the wheels wouldn't move. So, no, you're moving a little too fast. You're going to get out of here before my people get out. And so he just jammed their wheels. Like he made the wheels not turn in the chariots. And so he situates the whole Egyptian army right in the middle of the sea of water weed. And the Israelites get out on the other side, and he brings the water down. But even the water that might have been, that would make the bed so soft, that's pulled out, and they go over on dry land. And he caused them to walk in what was a moment ago, what was, you know, some time ago, a raging mass of water. They walked across that like they were walking in the wilderness for the next 40 years on absolute dry land. Verse 10, and he saved them from the hand of the one hating. I did think about translating this the hater, but that's a little too colloquial. You know, haters are going to hate. And he saved them from the hand of the one hating, a participle, and redeemed them from the hand of the enemy. Who's the hater here? Who's the enemy from whose hand they are redeemed? The Pharaoh and the Egyptian army. And waters covered up their adversaries. Not one of them was left. If you've ever wondered, out of all of the hordes, out of all of the hundreds that were in the Egyptian army, surely one of them got away. No, this says not one of them gets away. They all go in there, and then the water comes down, and it drowns all of them. And they believed his words. Okay, now we're not defying anymore, at least for the time being. What they did in verse 7. Now they see God. God said he would redeem us. God said that he would take care of us. Moses had said, stand still and see the salvation of Yahweh. You know, and now we believe it because we believe it after the fact. Now, that's not the time that you're supposed to believe it. You're supposed to believe it when it's said, not test out Yahweh your God. You shall not test out Yahweh your God. They believe it, though, only after they see it come to pass, and so now they have to. In one sense, they have to believe his words unless they're going to defy reality. They've seen what has happened. They've seen it with their own eyes, and they sang his praise. This sea of water weed incident happens in chapter 14 of Exodus. Chapter 15 is the song of Miriam. She gets a tambourine, and they compose a song, or she composes a song, a prophetic psalm, she was a prophetess, you know, and teaches this, and the women sing the song of Miriam, the song of Moses. Verse 13, though, here's, watch how fast. How fast does this change? How fast will they make it change? It says they hurried. Hurried to do what? Hurried to disbelieve again. They hurried. They forgot his occupations. Now, forgetting his extraordinaries is one thing. Forgetting his occupations is another. I think it's easier to forget just being a human, which means I'm dull. It's easier to forget occupations than it is extraordinaries. Because extraordinaries stand out to you. Occupations is just what God does all the time. But I think it should be the other way around. If you think about it, his occupations are the loving kindnesses that he does for us every day, all day, all day long. He does a lot more occupations than he does extraordinary. So I've got so much more reason to remember. I've got so many more things to remember in his occupations than I do in his extraordinaries. I mentioned this to one person, but only I just mentioned one aspect of it to them. It's been last week. I come over here when I pray. You know that I mention it from time to time. I'm praying about something over here, and I'll pray here. But I woke up this one morning this last week and just started praying into the morning ritual and beyond. You know, the morning ritual is, you know, shaving and showering and all that. And there's one prayer I pray every morning at that time. And you know, beyond all this, beyond the morning ritual, feed the cat, you know, take the dogs out, feed the birds. Why do I have a zoo at my house? I'm a farmer Metcalf here, but it's all inside. You know, and after you do the morning ritual, I don't like the morning ritual, but after you do the morning ritual, it's over and then you get about that. As I'm doing that, I just start realizing things that an insightful person of verse 7, somebody who had insight, would realize all the time. But I start just, they start hitting me. And I begin thanking God. And the hour that I usually spend here, I did it in the morning. Just thanksgiving. From one thing to another. One thing that God does, and they're all pretty much occupations. I wasn't thanking God, if you think about it, I wasn't thanking God for, here's just some of the extraordinaries that I've told you about. There are others that I haven't told you about, but I wasn't thanking God for healing Robert in Bible college, if you remember that story I've told you. I didn't thank him for that. Not that it's not worthy of thanks, but healing Robert of cancer then. I didn't thank him for that. I didn't thank him for healing my uncle from cancer. I didn't thank him for that Indian exorcism that he did through Matthew that time. Those are extraordinaries, okay? That's not every day. We don't see people healed of deadly diseases or having demons cast out of them every day. Those are extraordinaries that he does. I was thanking him for occupations. Occupations, we're dull. I mean, it's, maybe you're not this dull. I am. I'm dull like this. But it just started hitting me how good God is all the time. And I thanked him for a solid hour. Easily. Not trying to think of anything. It's coming to my mind faster than I can articulate it. His occupations, he's doing them constantly. He's occupied with it. And they forgot his occupations. All right, now, they weren't insightful into his extraordinaries in verse 7. But now they forgot his occupations in verse 13. So really, God, if you put them together, God does stuff for these people and they just don't care. They don't even think about it. Let me give it a second thought. They didn't intensely wait for his counsel. Might say they didn't wait much, or they didn't wait long, much or long, taking the place of my intensely here. The next time that there would be a problem. The next time. They didn't relate back to how God always deals with them. Nor did they relate back to the wonderful way that God has come through miraculously in time past. In other words, they didn't bank on occupations or properly relate to extraordinaries. As soon as the next exigency is upon them, here it comes. They don't wait on his counsel and they go back into complaining mode or whatever it is. The Exodus generation is a chronicle of God's utter mercy and Israel's utter ingratitude. Verse 14. And they always longed a longing in the wilderness, and they tried God in a desolation. What's this longing? Well, I'm sure they've got lots of longings. Now, we can give them this. They're not Americans, and they're not living in the 21st century, so they don't know how easy life can be. So they're not complaining about stuff that would just be science fiction to them. Why don't I have the internet? They're not considering cable TV a need, you understand. They're not thinking that they should have air conditioning in the desert. Well, judge these people all you want. We'd probably do a lot worse, given how much softer we are than they are. But they longed for certain things all the time, and you see them come up. You know, when somebody says something to you, and it seems so uncharacteristic of them, it's often a window into the way they always think. And we see certain things come out not just once. We see it come out like, really, every time you want to complain about your lot here in the wilderness, why does this always come up? We remember the leeks and the onions and the melons that we had in Egypt. That indicates that I want these things, and I want them badly. I long for them. Now, it's okay to want that. It's okay to say, I don't know why you want leeks, but it's okay to want leeks. It's okay. I don't know why you want onions, but it's okay if you want onions. But not as a charge against God, not as a complaint, not as a bitterness that's lodged inside the soul. All right, now, leeks and onions and melons seem rather petty. What is it that you feel, though, that you have this longing for, which I'm going to put it like this, that God isn't enough. Like, what is it that a relationship with God just doesn't satisfy? Like, what is higher than that in your life? Or what do you value maybe higher than that? Maybe you don't even value it higher than that. Is there something that we could say, you always long a longing in the wilderness? Now, there's nothing wrong with always longing a longing. I don't understand it. I really don't. I try to say, what is this? I try to stop myself and say, what is this that I'm feeling? Back when I used to go on a diet every once in a while, I just forget that. I'm not doing that anymore. All right? But when I used to do that, and I mean, Coke's not allowed on any diet. There's like no diet out there. And I say, what is this that I'm feeling right now? What is this irritability that I'm feeling? And what is this craving? Like, why is there this dissatisfaction? I want that so badly. Okay, I may want that. And you may want onions and leeks because you're in the Exodus generation. I can't see that being as strong a desire as my craving for Coke. But maybe it's stronger, huh? Because I'm not saying that I'm dissatisfied with life unless I have it. They are dissatisfied with life. I'm saying there's nothing wrong with longing for something. I'm saying there's nothing wrong with it, and that this doesn't tell us that. But the problem is the outcome, and the problem is the frame of reference. Here, they tried God in a desolation. This longing is there, and they said, can he provide a table in the wilderness? Now, I'm importing this from another place. Can he do that like we don't think God's able to? Like his ability is now in question? Or, I can't be content without whatever it is that the longing is for. And that was trying to God. That was trying him in a desolation. Now, what's the desolation? Very literally, it's the wilderness. There's nothing here. It's this desolate place. Now, here's the verse that we might spend more time on than the rest of it. Coming up, 15. And he gave to them their request. Now, this is not, that's the A part of the verse. So we need to read the B part of the verse. But the A part of the verse, it's not like it ends there. It's not, so you know what? God is just so, just incredibly good that he gave this to them. Gave them what they want, though they're perennial ingrates. This time it's a little different. He does good to them all the time, though they're perennial ingrates. But this is different. It says, he gave to them their request. That's the A part. Now we'll look at the second, the B part. And sent forth emaciation into their souls. Do you know that feeling? If you're on a diet or something, do you know the feeling that you like the feeling to come, but if you want to get off of the diet because it feels like you're actually, if you can actually feel like you're losing. You feel like, boy, I feel like my waist is thinner, smaller. I actually feel so, it's from the inside. It's like your stomach might be smaller because there's not so much in it. But you know that feeling like I there's this craving to glut myself, to put that in there, okay? And then you feel full again, okay. This is all physical. But when that feeling hits, and God sends as you're full, while you're full, these people anyway, while these people were full, God sent emaciation into their soul. You want this for your flesh? You're just not going to be happy unless you have this in your flesh, right? You've got to have this to be happy. And when you don't have to have this to be happy. What is it that's making you miserable? Well, do you have God? I have Jesus Christ. Why am I miserable? I have Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is far greater than any bad thing that I would have that would make me miserable. Are you sufficiently relating to Jesus Christ right now? The answer is no. When I'm feeling miserable because I think I'm deprived of something. In their case, He gave them what they wanted for their bodies, but He sent forth emaciation. We very seldom hear that word, but it's usually in connection with somebody who's starving or someone who's being starved by someone else. You see pictures of the Nazi Holocaust, and you see these emaciated bodies. We talk about those pictures of emaciated Jewish prisoners. Or you think of terribly malnourished people in famine situations that some of these, like child rescue organizations, will put on television or whatever. They see the child, and the child is emaciated. Right? Now, the body isn't all that important here when we're talking about relative importance, relative to the soul. My soul should be big. My soul should be strong, muscular, powerful. And He is giving them all kinds of means of grace for that to happen. But they're not taking Him up on that. They've got to have this meat that they want. We're talking about the quail here. It's not using that word, but they're lusting. And then He gives them what their soul desires, but He sends forth emaciation into their soul. Sent forth. Shalach is the Hebrew word for send, but it's in a PL form, so it's like send forth, or we need to somehow strengthen this. Like, God didn't just, it wasn't just allowing it to happen, He actually sent it. Soul emaciation happens when we value something more than God. Note this now, compare this with something in the New Testament so we understand God's ways. The Lord Jesus Christ, you remember in this, when He's teaching on prayer, and He's saying, which of you, and you being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children? Which of you, if your son asks you for bread, you're not going to give him a scorpion. If he asks for an egg, you're not going to give him a snake. Right? So how much more, if you being evil know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Heavenly Father give good things to those who ask Him? So if I ask God for something good, and my attitude is, God knows better than I do. I absolutely trust Him. I don't have a promise that I'm going to get this thing that I'm asking for. I think it's good. So I'm allowed to ask Him for it, and He wants to give me good things. So I'm going to ask Him for this thing that I think is good. And you know what? If it is, if it's good for me, He's going to give me that which is good. In the Psalms we read, we've already seen it in our trek through the Psalms here, no good thing will He withhold from those who walk uprightly. All right, now here's that's the first case scenario. That's the first case. Here's the second case. From 1 John 5. This is the confidence that we have in Him, that if we ask anything according to His will, He hears us. And if we know that He hears us, we know that we have received the things that we have requested from Him. Now, all of that's kind of hinging on that one piece of that verse I quoted, in His will. So that's what's going to make something good. So scenario number one was, if I ask God for something good, He'll give me something good. Scenario number two, if I ask God for something that I think is good, but it's not really good, He won't give me that because it's not His will. But all the time, whether I receive this thing or not, I'm not just a receiver. I'm not just about, give me what I want. I'm first and foremost a truster, not a receiver. If I don't receive this, I trust God. God knows what's best. God knows what's good. He's only going to do to me what is wisdom, justice, love, and truth. And so He may not actually give me this thing that I'm asking for, and I'm fine with that. So there's where we have scenario number two. I ask for something that I think is good for me, but it's not good for me, because if it were good for me, He'd give it to me. But it's not good for me. It's not His will. It's not His will to give me something that's not going to be good for me. So He withholds it. Now, our text today has scenario number three in it. I ask God for something that, you know what, there's nothing wrong with quail, and there's nothing wrong with longing in the wilderness. There is something wrong with putting that longing for quail, or whatever it is, over God so that you get bitter and resentful to God if you don't get it. In that situation, guess what? I'm asking now for something that in and of itself it may not be bad. But it's bad for me because of where my heart's at. He may give me that. You see the difference between scenario number one, two, and three? Scenario number one, I ask for something good, and I'm good with Him, and He'll give it to me. Scenario number two, I'm asking for something that I think is good, but it's not really good, but I'm good with Him. So neither one of us have a problem with Him doing good by not giving me what is bad for me. Scenario number three is, I'm not cool with God in this. I want what I want, and I want it yesterday. And if I don't get it, then I'm going to have a gripe, I'm going to have a complaint with God that I'm asking for something that, though maybe not in and of itself bad, it's bad for me. He may give me that. There is a scenario number four, just to round it all out, to cover all the bases, that doesn't exist, that can't exist, right? It's, I trust God, and I'm asking for something bad, and I know it's bad. Why am I going to do that? I know that one doesn't work. In their case, he said, okay, you've got it. And he's done this before, hasn't he? He's done it not just here. We see it elsewhere. We see it happen with other people around in the same generation, like with Balaam. Maybe if I just keep asking God whether I can go with these people, He'll change His mind. Or maybe something will change so that God will say the situation is different. Yes, go with these people and take their money. And God knows your Balaam, your disposition is way out of whack. You are valuing this money. You are valuing what the New Testament will call the wages of unrighteousness. And I've told you no. And there's a certain point where God says, okay, you can have that. But when He says it that way, and you never hear Him say it that way, you don't hear Him say it in that tone, but when He does it that way, it's like, now you ask for it. These are the ramifications. You're not trusting me that I know what's best for you by withholding this bad thing from you. So, all right, you won't just love me whether you have this or not. So have it. But don't complain when the natural ramifications of having that thing hit your soul. If you are of the mindset, if you are of the attitude that I don't like God if He does not give me this thing, then He may give you that thing and you will see why it was not the will of God to give you that. Before you even receive it, you've got soul emaciation. Your soul is shriveling up on the inside. Sometimes it's like this, though, that, listen, if we could speak as if I could speak as if I'm God speaking, and I understand I don't believe I'm a prophet to do that, but you'll understand my rhetoric if I do it this way. If we could say, look, as if God was saying, look, this isn't good for you. You want this, but you don't know variables. You don't know the specifics of the particular cases of what you're so pinpoint asking me about. You don't know the people that come along with that. You don't know the situations that opens you up to. You don't know where that's going to take you geographically. You don't know, and we can just go on. You don't know, we basically put it like this, you don't know anything. God knows everything. And He says, no. This happens, man. I'm not going to go into just trying to give you all the examples of ways this happens. But, I mean, I want this job. I don't care. I want that job. I want that job. Okay. And then if we would ask you at the time, based on God's knowledge, do you want your children to hate you? No. Is your children hating you worse having the job you want? Like, if I give you this job, but I tell you that your kids will end up hating you. Still want the job? And you're probably not going to say, yeah, still want the job. And some people are evil enough to say, yes, I still want the job. But no one's thinking, God, I'm asking you that my children hate me. No one's going to ask for that. But I want this job. And God can say, you don't know what you're asking. You get that job, then it's at that job that you meet this other person. And I know that your soul isn't up to meeting this other person. And you're going to commit adultery with that other person. And it's going to take you down this road, and you're going to be separated from your kids, and you're going to leave their mother, and your kids are going to blame you, and they probably should blame you. And your kids are going to hate you for the rest of your life. You're going to try like I'll get it. You're going to pray to me. You're going to try to say, make my kids love me, kind of thing. You wanted this job. I knew the job wasn't good for you. I knew what was there. I knew what was waiting for you. I knew what this is not good for you. But you had to have that job, okay? Along with the job is the fine print is your kids will hate you for the rest of your life. Let's just let God make our decisions for us, all right? We can ask Him. It's fine. I've got to have this person. You got to have that person? Let me tell you what goes with that person. I've got to have this money. You need to have that money? Let me tell you what goes with this money. I need to have this location. I need to have that. I just want this and I think I need to have it. And nothing's down the road. There's nothing bad about it. I just don't value God enough to recognize His wisdom in my life and to recognize that He loves me and to say, I'm content with God, no matter what, if I get the long thing I long for or not. That is, in and of itself, soul emaciating. And they were jealous toward Moses in the camp, toward Aaron, the Holy One of Yahweh. You know what that's about. That's the Dathan and Abiram and Korah rebellion. You take too much upon yourselves. All the people of God are holy. We want to be priests too. And then the earth opens up and swallows Dathan and covers over the congregation of Abiram. That's what happens in our Exodus generation, right? Moses said, God tells Moses, get all the people away from the tents of Dathan, Abiram, and Korah. Because the earth opens up and swallows them down alive to Sheol. And a fire burned in their congregation. A flame, intensely flamed, wicked ones. There was a judgment associated with their jealousy, their lust, their craving, their greed, their self-righteousness. And as we make our way through Psalm 106, you'll see more of this open up, and you'll see more of the lessons to be learned from the examples in the wilderness. One having ears to be hearing, let him be hearing.